coming up on Star Stuff.
It seems galaxies with the most active monster black holes tend to cluster closer to their neighbours. A new moon discovered orbiting around the distant ice giant Neptune. And a newly born nearby star system giving scientists a glimpse of how our own solar system would have formed 4.6 billion years ago. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new study has found that galaxies with the most active monster black holes tend to cluster closer to their neighbours than regular galaxies. The discovery, reported in the Astrophysical Journal, adds another piece to the puzzle of how star formation and galactic evolution are affected by supermassive black holes, millions to billions of times the mass of the Sun, which are thought to lurk deep in the hearts of many galaxies. One of the new study's authors, Dr. Heath Jones from Melbourne's Monash University, says astronomers have been scratching their heads trying to think of mechanisms capable of shutting down star formation in galaxies. The most popular candidates are active galactic nuclei, highly luminous compact regions at the centres of some galaxies. They're the most luminous energy sources in the universe, shining as beacons across billions and billions of light years. Active galactic nuclei are powered by ionized gas and other matter feeding a supermassive black hole. As gas or a hapless star is captured by the black hole's energy well, it doesn't fall straight into the black hole, but instead falls onto an accretion disk of material and debris orbiting perpendicular to the black hole's spin axis and just outside the event horizon. The event horizon is that point of no return, beyond which matter is stretched and crushed at the subatomic level as it falls forever into the black hole's singularity, a point of infinite density and zero size which can't be described by science's current understanding of physics. As matter nearest the black hole spins around the accretion disk, it's compressed and heated as it rubs against adjacent bits of matter just slightly further away, which are also moving around the accretion disk, but at slightly slower speeds thanks to Keplerian orbits. This friction generates enormous amounts of heat, generating temperatures in excess of 100,000 degrees, resulting in the emission of energy at all wavelengths, from gamma and X-rays right through to radio waves. However, because matter is rushing towards the black hole as well as spinning around it, the inward push of material travelling at supersonic speed abruptly stops just before reaching the event horizon due to the law of the conservation of angular momentum. You can see the law of the conservation of angular momentum in action when you spin dough to make a pizza. As the dough spins, it tends to expand outwards. The inward motion of matter stops when the pull of the black hole's gravity is balanced by the conservation of angular momentum trying to push spinning material back outwards. So not all the subatomic material in the accretion disk falls straight into the black hole. Some of it stopped and builds up in high-speed orbits just beyond the event horizon. Pressure in this orbiting material increases as new material piles onto the accretion disk, eventually pushing some of the superheated material out at right angles to the disk. Meanwhile, the magnetic fields being generated by all this ionized material are twisted into a helix by the spin of the accretion disk, corralling and focusing the outward flow of particles into jets which shoot out perpendicular to the disk and can be visible right across the universe. This glow is the deep space phenomena known as quasars, Seyfert galaxies, blazars, and radio galaxies. They're all believed to be the same thing, just being viewed from different angles. And they are so powerful, they can be among the most distant objects visible in the universe. Scientists think galaxies interacting or colliding with each other could increase the rate at which gas and other matter falls into the supermassive black hole, generating an active galactic nuclei. In fact, active galaxies are known to generally inhabit dense environments, which is consistent with this merger hypothesis. What Jones and colleagues did was try and find out whether or not mergers or close encounters between galaxies are really responsible for producing these active galaxies, or whether something more random could be causing it. The authors used the Australian six-degree field galaxy survey conducted by the Siding Springs Observatory, which allowed them to find a sample of 2,178 active galaxies with radio wavelength signatures. Radio-loud active galaxies were selected because they have strong signatures, providing a good way to select a large homogeneous sample of active galaxies. The researchers compared the active galaxies to a sample of less active galaxies with the same mass, the same brightness, and even the same stellar composition. They found the most active galaxies were all located within 522,000 light-years of a neighbouring galaxy. The authors say these findings are suggestive that mergers do play a role in the formation of the most powerful active galaxies. However, Jones says the findings only apply to active galaxies which were at least 200 times more powerful than their quieter counterparts.
We measured the degree of clustering that the active galaxies have compared to their radio quiet inactive counterparts. And what we found was that the differences between them weren't as large as we would have thought. The very strongest ones, there is a difference. But over the full range of radio power, then the differences we measure get smaller and smaller, the less powerful you go.
So what does that tell you?
So what that tells us is that this is by no means the end of the story. The plot thickens in that our understanding of exactly what mechanism lies at the heart of these galaxies to give them this active nucleus is not as straightforward as simply merging galaxies. And so it's opened up a lot of new interesting areas that we want to look into.
Now, when you did your comparison, you also took into account the total dark matter mass of the halo too, didn't you?
Yeah, so dark matter is an extremely important component of all galaxies. So it's the part of galaxies that we don't see with our telescopes, but we know that it must be there because otherwise galaxies wouldn't be able to hold their stars together. And so when you want to know what the total amount of matter in a galaxy is, then you really need to take account of the dark matter because even though you can't see it, it is responsible for most of the mass in that galaxy. And so to be able to do a fair comparison between galaxies in order to know exactly what a galaxy has, then you need to take into account the dark matter mass of the galaxy as well as the visible mass that we observe with the telescopes, of course.
That didn't make any difference in your results?
No. So, I mean, basically, we looked at different mass ranges, and no matter how you cut it, you really only see some small, very small differences for the most powerful radio galaxies.
That's Dr. Heath Jones from Melbourne's Monash University. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope has discovered another new moon. This one's orbiting the distant ice giant Neptune, the 14th known moon to be circling the outermost planet in the solar system. The moon, designated S2004N1, is estimated to be no more than 20 kilometres wide, making it the smallest known moon in the Neptunian system. Because it's so small and faint, it managed to escape detection by NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft when Voyager flew past Neptune back in 1989, surveying the planet's system of moons and rings. Mark Showalter from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, discovered the new moon on July 1st while studying the faint ring arcs, segments of rings which orbit Neptune. The method the astronomers used involved tracking the movement of a white dot that appears over and over again in some 150 archival Neptune photographs taken by the Hubble Space Telescope between 2004 and 2009. On a whim, Showalter looked far beyond the ring segments and focused on the white dot, about 104,000 kilometres from Neptune, located between the orbits of the Neptunian moons Larissa and Proteus. That dot turned out to be S2004N1. He then plotted the circular orbit of the moon, which, as it turns out, completes one revolution around Neptune every 23 hours. Well, these days they're the bad guys, but billions of years ago, greenhouse gases kept the early Earth warm enough to support life, despite our sun being much cooler than what it is now. The findings reported in the journal Astrobiology solve a 40-year-old riddle, first raised by famed astronomer Carl Sagan. known as the faint young sun paradox. You see, during the Archean epoch, some 2.8 billion years ago, the sun was between 20 and 30% less luminous than what it is today, raising questions about how life could have survived such a frozen environment. The New Study's authors, Eric Wolf and Professor Brian Toon from the University of Colorado, say increases in greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide and possibly also methane, may have been all it took. Geological evidence indicates that the early Earth was warm, there was liquid water and the emergence of life. However, at the same time, scientists also know that the sun was far less luminous back then, resulting in less sunlight reaching the Earth. So there are these two pieces of evidence which are at odds, and this is the paradox that Wolf and Toon have been trying to solve. Previous attempts to resolve the paradox used simple one-dimensional climate models, and they failed to capture all the complex variabilities associated with climate and weather. As a result, they produced findings ranging from a hot tropical planet Earth to a snowball Earth with runaway glaciation. However, Wolf and Toon found the solution to the paradox wasn't really all that difficult if you use new three-dimensional climate modelling simulations and, of course, new generation supercomputers needed to run them. They employed a sophisticated climate model, which was modified to reflect the early sun's energy output, as well as the atmosphere of the early Earth, where there was no oxygen or ozone, but at the same time lots of carbon dioxide and possibly methane. After 6,000 hours of computation time, the authors found conditions similar to or just slightly cooler than today's climate could be achieved if there was about 50 times more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of the early Earth than what there is now. Wolf and Toon were surprised by the modest amounts of carbon dioxide needed to keep Earth from freezing over completely. They had speculated that they would need hundreds of times more carbon dioxide compared to present levels. That simply wasn't the case. Wolf says the research shows that you can have an in-between state during this period, a state where some places are frozen, but others are still warm enough for liquid water and emerging life.
In our model, we found that we use 15,000 parts per million of CO2, which is a lot compared to present day, but in the terms of a paleoclimate context, it's a pretty modest amount. Because we get CO2 in our atmosphere, well, not only one from human causes, which we hear so much about today, but also from volcanic activity spews large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and there was much, much more volcanism on the early Earth, which would have helped support this much higher level of carbon dioxide in the early atmosphere. And the second gas is methane. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, which, because of the different chemistry on the early Earth, could have existed as much as 500 times greater or more than the methane content that we have on Earth today. So between those two greenhouse gases, CO2 and methane, they help warm the early Earth as well.
Is there any way of looking at what that atmosphere really would have been like? Is there any geologic method of doing that? I know we can work out whether a meteorite comes from Mars because little bits of atmosphere are trapped within that meteorite. We're talking about 2.8 billion years of the Earth's atmosphere you can analyze?
Yes, in fact there are. This is the job of geologists. Geologists go out into the field and there's numerous sites around the world. I know there's some sites in Canada and also in Australia where there's rock outcroppings near the surface that date back to not just 2.8 billion years, but as far back as 4 billion years, where they can take samples of the rock, and if we're lucky, they can study the chemistry in these rocks, and they can deduce how much carbon dioxide and other gases in the atmosphere there were during the early Earth. And this is actually where we get our constraints on carbon dioxide that I use in our climate model. It's from geologic evidence. We didn't just pull this number out of thin air. Well, geologists, they deduced the number from looking at the chemistry of these ancient rocks.
And so that backs up what you were saying before about heavier levels of CO2 in the air in those days.
It does, it does. And to touch on also the point of why we know the Earth was warm is that in the same method of looking at these ancient rocks, they can find chemical indicators of temperature and also indicators of liquid water processes existing near the surface, like erosional processes, sedimentary processes. And from this, we can deduce that there was liquid water at the surface And from that, that is a temperature constraint. If you have liquid water, you know it must be above freezing.
The continental area of Earth was smaller back then, so there was less weathering of the land. I take it by that we're talking about the sea levels were higher because of warm temperatures, or what?
Well, no, it's actually the land hadn't emerged yet. You can think about it in terms of the Hawaiian Islands, how you have geologic activity which has slowly built the Hawaiian Islands over time. Are on a much larger scale, all the continents of the Earth were slowly built over time. So it's not that the sea level was higher, it's that there was just less land.
And there was just less land back then.
It hadn't
built up.
It hadn't been built yet.
Describe the Earth as it would have been then based on your findings.
The early Earth would have been much different than today. First of all, there was no oxygen and no ozone on the Earth. As we mentioned, carbon dioxide would have been much higher than, say, the methane concentrations would have been up to 500 times more than today. There wouldn't have been much land, and the land that did exist, there wasn't any plant life or mammals walking the surface of the land, only microbes living in the oceans. There would have been much more volcanic activity, spewing ash and CO2 high into the atmosphere. And it's also believed that with these high levels of methane in the atmosphere, there might also have been a thin haze layer like seen on Titan might have formed as well. So certainly the early Earth would have looked like an alien world to any visitor from the present day if they were to go back in time and visit the early Earth.
That's Eric Turner, PhD candidate with the University of Colorado. New data from NASA's Mars rover Curiosity indicates the red planet's once thick atmosphere was most likely degassed or blasted into space rather than condensed and frozen in the soil. The six-wheeled car-sized rover has measured the abundances of different gases and different isotopes in several samples of Martian atmosphere. Isotopes are variants of the same chemical element with different atomic weights due to having different numbers of neutrons, such as the most common carbon isotope carbon-12 and its heavier stable counterpart, an isotope known as carbon-13. Evidence that rivers and oceans once filled the Martian landscape billions of years ago point to a much thicker atmosphere with a warmer, wetter climate. The rarefied atmosphere of today is just 1% of Earth's atmospheric pressure, and so is too scant for liquid water to persist on the surface now. It's believed when Mars cooled down sufficiently for its geodynamo to stop generating a global magnetic field to protect it from the sun, solar winds and radiation tore away the planet's atmosphere, slowly destroying it. Reports in the journal Science have examined ratios of both heavier and lighter isotopes of carbon and oxygen in the red planet's carbon dioxide atmosphere. Heavier isotopes of carbon and oxygen are both enriched in the planet's thin atmosphere today compared to the proportions in the raw materials that would have formed Mars 4.6 billion years ago. That provides not only supportive evidence for a loss of much of the planet's original atmosphere, but also some clues as to how that loss could have occurred. As the atmosphere was lost, the signature of the process was embedded in the isotopic ratio. The enrichment of heavier isotopes measured in the dominant carbon dioxide gas points to a process of loss from the top of the atmosphere, which would favour the loss of lighter isotopes rather than a process of the lower atmosphere interacting with the ground. Curiosity measured the same pattern in isotopes of hydrogen as well as carbon and oxygen, all consistent with a loss of a substantial fraction of Mars's original atmosphere. The enrichment in heavier isotopes in the Martian atmosphere had previously been measured on Mars in the 1970s by the Viking landers and in gas bubbles inside Martian meteorites found on Earth. Martian measurements indicate much of the atmospheric loss may have occurred during the first billion years of the planet's 4.6 billion year history. Curiosity's measurements are providing more precise data to compare with meteorite studies and with existing models of Martian atmospheric loss. Mind you, Curiosity isn't directly measuring the current rate of atmospheric escape on Mars, but NASA's next mission of the Red Planet, the Mars Atmospheric and Volatile Evolution Mission, MAVEN, will do so. The MAVEN mission is now slated for launch in November. The Curiosity rover landed inside the Gale impact crater near the Martian equator on August the 6th last year. After studying Martian soil and discovering a dried-up riverbed, the rover's now commenced its long drive towards Mount Sharp, a 5-kilometer-high mound of stratified rock which scientists hope will provide them with new details about the planet's climatic and geologic history. A newly born nearby star system is giving scientists a glimpse of how our solar system would have formed 4.5 billion years ago. The study, reported in the journal Science, has identified what astronomers call a snow line around the star TW Hydra. A snow line is a place where carbon monoxide is condensing out of a protoplanetary disk, in the process providing seeds for future planets and comets. The study's lead author, Dr. Chunhua Ki from the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, says it's the first time a carbon monoxide snow line has been detected around a sun-like star. Snow lines are locations out from stars where conditions are cool enough for specific chemicals to condense out of a protoplanetary disk around a new star. Different molecules such as water, carbon dioxide, methane, ammonia, and carbon monoxide all freeze out at different temperatures, resulting in a series of different snow lines. Snow lines can also enhance the efficiency of planetary formation because ices are more sticky than bare grains, and so they tend to clump together more easily, helping to pile up dust grains and ices, which will eventually grow to form entire planets. Key and colleagues used ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Telescope in Chile, to look for a snow line around a young K-class Titori star less than a million years old called TW Hydra. All young stars go through a Titori phase when they have very strong stellar winds. This newborn star is about 0.8 solar masses, making it slightly smaller and cooler than the Sun. But it is only 175 light-years from Earth, making it the nearest and, as such, most intensively studied pre-main sequence star. In fact, its size and mass closely conforms with estimates of what our own solar system would have been like at a similarly young age. Key and colleagues looked for a reactive ion called diazonelium, which identified the location of a carbon monoxide snow line. See, carbon monoxide can't be imaged directly, so instead the team used diazonelium as a proxy because it only exists when carbon monoxide freezes out onto dust grains. Key and colleagues identified the position of the carbon monoxide snow line around the disk and say it corresponds to Neptune's orbit around the Sun in our solar system. They selected carbon monoxide rather than water because it's easier to find. The water snow line would have been much closer into the star. In our own solar system, the water snow line is between the main asteroid belt and Jupiter. Key and colleagues hoped to probe for different kinds of snow lines around different kinds of stars and also look for volatiles, including organic molecules.
Of course, we would like to use this proxy to look for a seal snow line in other disks, which is that we would like to see the evolution of this snow line change with the time to provide statistics how this snow line, depending on the parameters of those interesting parameters about the planet formation theory, such as the age and the age of the disks, the evolutionary stage of the disk.
The next thing is to look for more evolved systems so you can see how the snow line moves out.
Yes, yeah. using these nice probes
yep.
to find out where those locations, yes. We hope to find other such things that we can probe for different kind of snow lines, different kind of volatiles, even like N2 and this kind of volatiles, to help us to define the...
planetary characteristics.
Yeah, right.
You were saying nitrogen. Would you be able to look for other things too, or will you be able to go inwards, or are you always going to be looking for things further out like methane and that sort of thing?
One of the things we hope to look for is actually organic species. How this organic species distributed to the nebula analog, and this definitely helped us to understand how the organics then got transferred to Earth-like planets. This kind.
That's Dr. Chunhua Ki from the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. An Italian astronaut has survived a near drowning in space, but NASA is yet to identify exactly how his life came to be in such danger. Luca Parmitano was on a spacewalk outside the International Space Station when water suddenly began leaking into his helmet. The ABC's North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports he was unable to see, hear or talk as his colleagues performed an emergency retrieval.
NASA's flight director described what it was like rather bluntly. "Go stick your head in a fishbowl and try to walk around," he said. Initially, Luca Parmitano told Ground Control he thought it was sweat in his helmet.
"I see beads of sweat. No, it's not sweat.
No, it's not sweat."
"Hey, Luca, can you clarify, is it increasing or not increasing?"
"It's hard to tell, but it feels like a lot of water."
"Oh, I see it now, wiggling."
He says he doesn't understand where it's coming from. Ground Control asks if he sucked all the water out of his drink bag. He says he has.
"FYI, I feel a lot of water on the back of my head, but I don't think it leaked from my bag."
"Are you sweating? Are you working hard?"
"I am sweating, but feels like a lot of water."
On only his second spacewalk, Luca Parmitano felt the water increasing.
"But where's it coming from then? It's too much."
"I don't know. It's a lot.
Nice in my eyes."
Now with water in his eyes and his hearing affected, Ground Control terminated the spacewalk and brought him back inside. When his colleagues took his suit off, water floated away. The Italian astronaut was seen blowing his nose. NASA Mission Management Team Chairman Kenny Todd.
"Clearly we have a problem at this point that we don't quite understand, and we're going to take the next day or two and sort through that, probably do a little bit of troubleshooting on orbit, and the team will be working through the fault tree and trying to determine what kind of things that we could do on orbit and here on the ground to try to get a better understanding of what's going on. So that's kind of what I would term the immediate future."
NASA says it will take as long as it can to discover the reason for the leak, whether it was from cooling system water tanks or liquid cooling. Marcia Smith was a space policy expert at the Congressional Research Service for more than three decades and is a former director of the Space Studies Board.
"Spaceflight is, of course, always risky, and you're at risk when you go up to a space station, you're at risk when you go out on a spacewalk because you're basically in a miniature space station. So spaceflight is always risky."
How dangerous is it when a spacesuit appears to malfunction like this?
"Well, it's always dangerous because you're outside the space station. You need some amount of time to get back to the airlock, inside the airlock, and then to repressurize the airlock. So what they were concerned about was that he could actually drown inside the helmet because of the way water acts in zero gravity. And so they clearly expressed concern that this could have been a very dire emergency situation. And what surprises me the most is that they are surprised at this failure, and they really don't understand it even now."
NASA says this 1 hour and 32 minute spacewalk by Luca Parmitano is now the second shortest in history. The shortest was in 2004, when an astronaut was recalled after 14 minutes when a pressure sensor failed.
ABC's Michael Vincent reporting. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.